Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governor, and I'll be your chair for today's program. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And today, you're going to hear a fascinating conversation about spycraft between our featured speaker, political science professor Uri Bar-Yosef, Israel of Israel's University of Haifa, and our moderator, Janet Napolitano, president of the University of California and the former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. This is the third in a limited series of Commonwealth Club interviews being done by President Napolitano. Professor Uri Bar-Yosef is the author of the new book, The Angel, The Egyptian Spy Who Saved Israel. And the book centers around a man named Ashraf Marwan, whose mysterious death remains unsolved more than 9 years after Mr. Marwan plunged from the balcony of his fifth-floor London apartment to the ground below. For decades, Mr. Marwan betrayed the Egyptian homeland to work as a spy for Israel. And Professor Bar-Yosef will reveal his research into secret archives to examine the life and career of Mr. Marwan, who notably saved Israel from a devastating defeat at the outset of the 1973 Yom Kippur War and worked for Israeli intelligence through 1998. Professor Bar-Yosef specializes in national security intelligence studies and the Arab-Israeli conflict. He earned his PhD right here at Stanford University. Our moderator tonight, Janet Napolitano, became the 20th president of the University of California in 2013, and she leads a university system with 10 campuses, 5 medical centers, 3 affiliated national laboratories, and a statewide agricultural and natural resources program. From 2009 to 2013, she was the first woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. And from 2003 to 2009, Ms. Napolitano served as the 21st governor of the state of Arizona, becoming Arizona's third female governor and the first woman to win re-election. So now let's get ready for an amazing spy story as well as a discussion of the art of espionage. Please welcome Professor Uri Bar-Yosef and President Janet Napolitano.
Well, thank you, and thank you for joining us, Professor, tonight to discuss your book, The Angel, which is a fascinating read, and I say that as someone who always enjoys a good spy novel. This one is real, and so let's take our audience back. I think, to begin, what got you interested in the story of Ashraf Marwan, and what kind of a character did you find him to be as you conducted your research?
Well, this is, in a way, it is also a personal story because I was a soldier in the war of 1973, the Yom Kippur War. I was a reserve soldier, and I was called at 2 o'clock on October 6, 1973, from home. I thought it would be a 3 days war. After 5 months, I returned home, and many of my friends did not. In fact, this was the most intensive war in Israeli history. We, in terms of, or in proportion to American population, we lost something like 300,000 soldiers in 3 weeks, which is quite terrible. And like everyone else, I returned home asking the question, why? What happened? How come Israel, with its great intelligence services, didn't know that war was coming? And then the question continued to haunt me. I joined military intelligence, and I learned how the analytical job is done. And then I did my studies at Stanford. My PhD was on intelligence and politics, came out as a book, and I continued to serve as a reserve officer in the in military intelligence, and now and then they would call me to give lectures to cadets, you know, things like that. And they always wanted me to speak about surprise attacks. So I spoke about Barbarossa, I spoke about Pearl Harbor, I spoke about Yom Kippur. And each time that I finished, I told them, but it is a shame that military intelligence so far did not investigate what happened in 1973. So in 1998, they called me for a special service, 60 days. They gave me all the documents on the war and told me, okay, now you make the study. So I made the study. It is top secret, so I can't read it anymore, but nevertheless, I know more or less what's in it. And when I read, we had something like 400 warnings before the war. But when you read these warnings, you see that there is a bunch of about 10, 12 warnings which are really exceptional, the jewel in the crown. It was obvious that they came from a human source, from a spy who was very close to President Sadat. And I didn't ask, no one told me who it was. But slowly, I wrote a book later about the war, and shortly after the book came out, the name of the spy was leaked. And it became known publicly that he was the son-in-law of President Nasser of Egypt and a very close aide of President Sadat, who replaced him in September 1970. And I still couldn't write about him because he was alive, and I felt committed not to do anything as long as he is alive. But then, as it was told here, I mean, we know what happened. He died mysteriously in 2007, and then I felt that I can start
tell
doing
the story.
This. Yes, and I start writing the book. So this is the very short answer to your.
The story, so he gives a warning. Or a set of warnings about the upcoming Yom Kippur War, but his performance as a spy began many years before. And can you just share with us what kind of a man Marwan was, how he got close to the inner circle, both in Nasser's government and then with Sadat's, I'd like to get into how he actually got in touch with Israeli intelligence, because that's an interesting part of the book.
Well, he was young, shrewd, clever, bright, handsome, and very ambitious, with a huge ego. And he played tennis. And on the tennis courts in Heliopolis Club, which is the best club in Cairo, he met this young woman. She was 17 then. She happened to be the daughter of President Nasser. And President Nasser, we speak about the 1960s, mid-1960s, was like a god. There was no Arab leader like him before that and after that. He was the most admired person in the Arab world, and I think he still is. And she fell in love with him. Which is quite natural because he was okay.
Things happen at tennis clubs.
Yes, and her father, though, was quite suspicious because he understood, how should I put it mildly, Mona, the daughter of President Nasser, wasn't so beautiful, she wasn't so intelligent. So her father suspected that Marwan's interest in her is not because of her personal quality, but because, you know, he is her father or she is his daughter. And therefore, he didn't like the idea of the marriage too much. And here we come really to a beautiful drama where he doesn't want her to marry Marwan, but she cries. And at the end, the greatest Arab leader yields to her tears and agrees to the marriage, and it is a wonderful marriage there.
They have a son.
The ceremony was very beautiful of the marriage, with the best Arab singers, you know, and it was televised in the Egyptian TV. And the marriage between them was okay. They had a firstborn son. The problem was that, on top of everything else, Marwan wasn't only very ambitious, he also loved a good life. It was after 1967, after the war of 1967, Egypt was defeated in this war. The atmosphere in Cairo wasn't so happy. Both Marwan and his wife wanted to get out. They moved to London. Marwan used to gamble in the best casinos in London. The problem was that he didn't have the money to do it. So a Kuwaiti oil sheikh helped him quite a lot. Nasser heard about it, didn't like it, pressured again, Mona to divorce him. She cried again. He yielded again. But they returned to Cairo. And shortly afterwards, President Nasser died. Right. But I think that for Marwan, his relationship with Nasser were sort of a trigger to do what he did, because he was very frustrated by Nasser, by his attitude toward him. And I think that, well, consciously or not, he wanted to take revenge. And what is a better revenge than to spy for the greatest enemies of Nasser?
You know, I must say that that's one of the great mysteries of the book, you know, his motivation for doing people are ambitious. They marry for perhaps ambition as much as for love. That's a tale, that's a very old tale, but they don't often become traitors against their country. That step is kind of mysterious in the book as to why he would do that. And the way he did it is also mysterious. And so here they are. They both like the high life, let's be honest. They like to gamble, totally contrary to Nasser's own values, who lives a very simple lifestyle, and that's part of his popularity, is he doesn't buy into, you know, all of the accoutrements of power, so to speak. There they are in London. He's got his friend, the oil sheikh from Kuwait, I think. Yes. He's gambling in the best casinos, as you say. But then it seems like out of the blue, he decides to reach out to Israeli intelligence. And you might share with the audience what actually happened, how he did this. It's a strange thing.
Can I say a word before that about his motivation?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure it will come up, why did he do it? And you related to it already. Spies are not regular persons. And you need to be a special kind, or you have to have a special kind of personality in order to become a spy. Not want to be a spy. Every child wants to be a spy. But not many do. And Marwan did it. Why? I would say that apart from his frustration with his relationship with Nasser, he had a huge ego. And he wanted to influence history. And the way he found, you know, the way he wanted to influence history was by siding with the winners in the Arab-Israeli conflict at that time, the Israelis. And this way he also became important, because he knew that he is very important for the Israelis. The chief of the Mossad used to meet him personally. He was a general. And for Marwan, the fact that he was sitting, like the two of us are sitting, but with no audience, and chats with a general of the Israeli, of the victorious Israeli army, and it was after the Six-Day War, it filled him up with it boosted his ego, and the Israelis knew it very well, and this was the reason why the chief of the Mossad used to sit with him. So it was this, it was also money. And I think that for Marwan, there was also one more issue. He was a risk taker. Some of us are risk takers, so we do bungee jumping every morning. For him, it was spying for the Israelis. And I think that this is the reason why spied for the Israelis and not for the Americans, for example, because for the Israelis, it was more than dangerous. And altogether, it created a situation that allowed Israel to have the best source that the country have ever had in an Arab country, and at a very critical period of time.
So how did he reach out to the Israelis?
Well, he was in London. He came to London quite often. He just picked up the telephone and called the Israeli embassy and asked to speak with someone from the Mukhabarat, which is intelligence.
Like you found the number in the phone book and
yes,
called the embassy?
Yes, yes, it's very simple. The telephone number of the embassy is in the phone book, you know.
It's in the book. I mean, it's amazing.
In fact, it wasn't so simple because the person who spoke with him, which was from the military attaché office, the military attaché wasn't in good relations with the Mossad. So they didn't immediately pass the name. But once they passed the name, the Mossad guys in London, they jumped because they knew about Marwan. They already wanted to get him, but they felt that he was too important, too highly placed, and they won't be able to get him. And here he comes to them, what we call a walk-in, and that's it. And within 24 hours, they met him already in a hotel room in London, and he came already with documents to give them an example of what he can give. And when they saw it, they understood that there's one of them, very experienced intelligence officer, said something like this. It happens once in 1,000 years or something like this. So,
how did the Israelis determine whether he was actually spying for them or whether he was actually a double agent?
Well, the question of him, obviously, when you have a walk-in,
right,
you suspect him.
Like, hello.
Especially if he's the son-in-law of President Nasser. But the Israelis, we have good intelligence. Good collection.
I would agree with that.
Yes. And we knew a lot about Egypt. So it was easy to compare what Marwan gave to what we had already. And all the time they compared what he gave to information from other sources, and it was obvious that what he gave was authentic. Now, you have to understand, usually spies, when they meet their handlers, they tell them stories. They tell them this and this and this. I read this, I heard this, things like that. With Marwan, it was different. He brought documents because he was sitting next to Sadat. And he was the son-in-law of President Nasser. He could lay his hands on every document the Israelis wanted. So if it was the protocols of the Egyptian high command meetings, sometimes Sadat would say to Marwan, you know, you go instead of me to these meetings. So Marwan used to go to these meetings and take notes for Nasser. So he took two copies of the notes, you know, one for Nasser, One for Golda Meir. It's and this is the way it worked. But in other cases, it was the original documents. For example, every division commander in the Egyptian army, or at least some of them, had the Egyptian war plans: how to attack Israel, how to cross the Suez Canal, advancing to the Sinai, etc. So Balwan gave the Israelis the same plans, but didn't tell them about it. He gave them the original plan. And the same is true with regard to Sadat talks with foreign leaders, including the Soviet leadership. Sadat went in 1972 to speak with Brezhnev in the Kremlin about Egypt's needs in arms in order to go to war. So about shortly after Sadat finished his visit in the Kremlin, we had the protocols of these talks, including Brezhnev asking, where are these passes in the Sinai? So Sadat climbs on the table and shows him on the map where it is. Things like that. And in fact, these protocols were important enough, so Israel Prime Minister Golda Meir, who went to for a visit in the U.S., met with President Nixon and with Henry Kissinger, the six of them in the Oval Office, and there she gave them the protocols in order to show first what are the intelligence Israel's intelligence capabilities, and then to show them that Israel is ready to share with the U.S. its best kept secrets, and both of them were highly impressed.
They should have been in, and you have to put this story against the context of the time. You have it is during a period when Egypt is aligned with the Soviets, Israel with the United States. You have Cold War politics that are in play. You have questions about Egypt's actual ability to carry out an attack, and so the need for knowledge about what had been acquired by them militarily. All of this was something that Marwan, the angel, as he was as called, played a critical part in.
Yes. We knew that the Egyptians were not ready yet to go to war, but Marwan gave us the precise information why the Egyptians feel that they cannot yet go to war. They thought that without getting a sufficient number of attack aircraft that would be able to attack Israel's air bases and thus neutralize Israel's air superiority, and without getting Scud missiles that will be able to attack Tel Aviv, in order to deter Israel from attacking Cairo, without getting these two weapon systems, Egypt won't go to war. And in fact, this was, of course, the way the Egyptians thought about it, except that in late a year before the war, Sadat decided that he cannot wait anymore for this weapon, so he decided to go without them. And he called his high command and told them, we go to war with the weapon system that we have. We
this
don't
is
wait.
Now. This is
Sadat, yes. He came to power in September.
That's right.
1970. Nasser died. And he tells them in October 1972, he tells his high command, we're going to war with the weapon systems we have and get organized. And of course, there is a protocol for this meeting. And of course, who gets the protocol if not, again, Golda Meir? So the question is, of course, why were we surprised?
And well, that was going to be my next question. Why were you surprised?
I wrote a 500 pages book about it, so I'm afraid. afraid. I look at the over
in,
there.
In less than 500 pages, but why? Because you have Marwan supplying some warnings. There's a question about why his warnings were so late. Now, this is for the Yom Kippur War. But his warnings were not believed by everyone in the Israeli intelligence world, just as his original contact wasn't originally accepted. And so he kind of got into some Israeli internal politics there. Am I right?
Yes, yes. About a year, same time that the Sadat decided to go to war without waiting for additional arms, A new chief of military intelligence enters office, and he's how should he's the type of person you really don't want as intelligence chief, because he's what we call a person with a very high need for cognitive closure. I hope there are not too many psychologists here, but it is a person. Simply put, it is a person who cannot live in the gray area. Everything must be either black or white. And therefore, he cannot also remain with, when he faces an important question, he must immediately give an answer and is not ready to reopen this answer to a new discussion. Even when new information contradicting this answer, his answer comes in.
Kind of dug in, and
yeah. Yes. He's blocking any possibility. Like, and you know, Marwan was the one who said, who told the Israelis, Sadat will not go to war without getting the aircraft, the attack aircraft. And then in June, the same Marwan tells us the Egyptian generals say that they don't need the aircraft anymore. They find a solution to the problem.
Right.
No one listens. They listen to him when he say they won't go to war. They don't listen to him when he said they are capable of going, or they say that they can go to war. So the main answer is in the personality of this very strong director of military intelligence, and he was in Israel then and now. Military intelligence is the main intelligence agency. It's the what we call the national estimator. So the question of if Egypt or Syria go to war is a question that military intelligence answers, not the Mossad, no one else. So he said until the very last moment that Egypt will not go to war. In fact, he was very, very much surprised when fire started.
Yeah. And we know the outcome of that. Now, Marwan continues to spy for Israel, unclear to me what his continuing motivation is, and maybe you could discuss that, and also how his identity was ultimately disclosed.
Well, he sided with the Israelis for reasons that we again the
something was ego and ambition.
It was ego. It was ambition. Perhaps it was habit already.
I have a habit of spying.
Yeah. Once you start it, you know, it's not so bad. So why not continue? But the interesting thing is, you know, about 14 hours before war started, Israel was still completely unaware that war is coming, and Marwan met, he demanded to meet immediately the chief of the Mossad, and they met in London about 14 hours before war started. Right. And then he told him, war will start tomorrow, and the chief of the Mossad hurried up to the telephone to call Israel. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, about 8 hours before war started, the telephone started ringing in the near the bed of Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan, the chief of staff, and woke everyone up to a war that will start within a few hours, which was really bad. And there were questions, as you said, about why he gave the warning so late. I have answers to this. But the funny thing is that in the next meeting between Marwan and the chief of the Mossad, which took place during the war, half of this meeting was spent on Marwan's complaints that Israel was surprised in the war. So you see this Egyptian patriot complaining that its worst enemy wasn't surprised by his own country. It is a very, I mean, when it comes to his motivation to do things, it is very, very complicated. story. I would just say in one word that the fact that Israel received this warning something like 10 hours before war started still allowed the Israelis to start mobilizing the reserve army on Yom Kippur, and the units that were mobilized at 10 o'clock in the morning stopped the Syrian army from advancing to the Jordan Valley in the Golan Heights something like 24 hours later. So without Marwan's warning, it is very, very likely that the Syrians would have taken over the entire Golan Heights, and war under such circumstances would have been far, far more difficult for Israel.
Once you have the Golan Heights, you've got the high country, and it's very, very close to Jerusalem.
To take over the Golan Heights again would be a very difficult task.
Indeed.
Yeah, so Israel was very unlucky, as it usually happens to states which are surprised, like the United States in Pearl Harbor, 9/11. But we were lucky that we received this last-minute warning, because otherwise the situation would have been far worse.
That 10 hours was critical.
Critical, yes.
Speaking of time, let me just remind our audience that we are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program. Our guest is Professor Yuri Bar-Joseph of the University of Haifa in Israel. We are discussing his new book about Ashraf Marwan, the Egyptian citizen turned Israeli spy. I'm Janet Napolitano, president of the University of California, and your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel. Let's turn back to the angel, and I want to leave time. We have some great questions from the audience. But can you talk about how his identity was ultimately disclosed and what happened there?
Okay. Towards the end, about 10, 15 years after the war, the early 1990s, it became known that Israel received a last-minute warning that prevented a complete surprise from a miraculous source. But no one knew who this source was, it could be Syrian, it could be Egyptian, it could be Iraqi. No one knew who he was. And then slowly but surely, we started to get indication to who this source was. The best indications came from the book that the director of military intelligence in 1973, the person with the high need for cognitive closure, wrote and published in 1993. And in fact, if you read this book, you can see who the source was, his identity, really, because his name was mentioned there. But this was not enough. So this director started leaking his name to reporters and journalists and writers and so on. Why he did it? We assume that the reason is that all the blame for the intelligence fiasco fell on his shoulders. He wanted to remove it. The best way that he found to remove it was to claim or describe this miraculous source as a double agent to fool the Israelis. Now he was the miraculous source. Ashraf Marwan was operated by the Mossad. If he fooled the Israelis, if he was a double spy, it was the fault of the Mossad, not of military intelligence.
So once again, we have internal Israeli intelligence politics.
Precisely. So turning him into a double agent was the best way for him to get rid of the burden of the guilt, of what happened in 1973, which until today is the biggest trauma in Israel's history. And Israel is not Switzerland. We had some traumas. So this was his way. And on the way, he also exposed the identity of Marwan. It became fully known in 2002. And in late 2002, it was published in the Egyptian press, and yet the Egyptians did nothing. And of course, the question is why they did nothing.
They honored him at a funeral.
Well, the funeral was in 2007. The organ between them. We assume that they understood that he was a spy, that he was a traitor. But it was very difficult for them to admit that a person like this, who is married to the daughter of Nasser, who is close advisor of Sadat, whose son is the best friend of the son of President Mubarak, Jimmy Mubarak, that he is the worst traitors in Egypt's history. And he's one of them. If you may remember Kim Philby, who was a British spy for the Soviets. And one way or another, the British intelligence preferred that he will defect to the Soviet Union rather than to put him to trial in England.
Right.
In the Egyptian case, well, he had nowhere to defect. There was no Soviet Union, and I don't think that coming to Israel was a possibility for him. No. No, but so the Egyptians did something else. They just got rid of him, and this way they got rid of this very embarrassing problem.
Do you, one of the things that comes out in the book and also in intelligence generally is what is the value of human intelligence, human versus all of the SIGINT, the kind of signals intelligence you get by intercepting calls and the like, and how that fits into the constellation of how one acquires information.
At the beginning of the 20th century, we hardly had any what we call technical intelligence. We had only human intelligence, only spies. But the progress of ways of communication allows spy agencies also to monitor what is said between people. And the belief among many is that today you don't really need spies. You can do it through technical means, SIGINT and VISINT and etc. Visual intelligence and signal intelligence, monitoring, etc. The truth is that there is no substitute for spies. And I think that the reason for that is that because in when it comes to technical means, there is a sort of an arms race. You improve your monitoring capabilities, the other side improves its way of preventing you from listening to to what's going on, etc., etc. When it comes to spies, there is no spy-counter-spy. Maybe in fiction there is spy-counter-spy, but in reality it is very difficult. And in this sense, spies were, and I believe will continue to be, extremely important. And by the way, the Second World War proved it in an excellent way, although signal intelligence played an extremely important role in this war with the Ultra and the magic. I recently we had the Russian involvement in American elections.
Right.
And we don't know exactly what the Russians did, what they did not, how much Putin knew, how much he did not. Just imagine that you have someone like Marwan next to Putin. You know everything. And far better than any signal intelligence can tell you.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
so
right.
I suggest that it's time to get someone like this. Yeah.
if we don't have one already. What, did you have any roadblocks to gathering and then publishing the information contained in the book? Did you have to get approvals from different sources, et cetera?
It's a very complicated book, primarily because the story is mainly the story of the Mossad. Now, the Mossad is not the type of agency that cooperates, at least 10 years ago, it wasn't the type of agency that cooperated with external researchers. However, during my, I did many studies on the on Israeli intelligence, on the case of Yom Kippur, which is the most important, most interesting case. And I got, the chief of the Mossad in 1973 is a personal friend of mine now, and some others are as well. So they were ready to talk, but in a very regarded manner, and it took many hours to get them to tell the story. Not because they didn't want to tell me the story, but because these are people who were trained all their lives to keep secrets. They are not like the director of military intelligence. And
so they weren't writing their own book about
this
episode.
They weren't writing the director of military intelligence of the Mossad in 1973 wrote his memoirs. I spoke with him a lot about it to write his memoirs, and he did at the end. But believe me, he wrote it. It was published 2 years after my book came out in Israel, and there was nothing new there about the angel. I mean, he knows until today many secrets. He doesn't tell them. So getting them to tell the story was difficult, but also very interesting. And I must say that the Israeli censorship was quite liberal when it came to allowing the secrets coming out, and I don't have any complaints.
Right, you know. Right. Well, and also Marwan is now dead, so that makes the dynamic a little bit different.
Yes, I think that there is now it is also a matter of a question of prestige. Was he really a double agent to fool the Israelis? And of course, the Mossad, everyone in the Mossad believe he was not, and they know the story. They know the story. The ones who claim that he was a double agent are mainly the Egyptians. And I must say, I think that the Egyptians simply don't know until today the story. Well, they read my book, they read some other things, but
well,
they don't.
It's embarrassing for them to have somebody like that.
It is extremely embarrassing for them. After Mubarak was removed from power, some Egyptian newspaper wrote that he gave the order to get rid of Marwan, which is not surprising. But until today, there is no open debate on whether Marwan spied for the Israelis or was an Egyptian
double agent. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And Marwan's death is still unexplained. I mean, we know how he died. He was seen falling from a fifth-floor balcony.
Yes, and he wasn't flying, and it wasn't an accident because he was in a very poor health, and it took him. It was difficult for him to climb in order to fall, so he made an effort to fall, and of course the question is why. And I think that accident was ruled out in light of his poor health, and suicide was ruled out because he was seen in quite a good mood that morning. And the people who saw him on this balcony before his death saw him getting into his bedroom, returning to the balcony, going to the bedroom, returning after a couple of minutes to the balcony, and then on the third time, I think, he just returned to the balcony, jumped. And the question is, what happened in the bedroom? And, of course, we don't have an answer, but we can speculate. You know that in the Roman army, an intelligence officer was called speculator. And it remains until today. My speculation is that there were some Egyptian intelligence officers in the room. They told him something like this: either you jump and we'll tell everyone that you were a hero, worked for the Israelis, and the Mossad killed you. And of course, your wife, your sons, they will be able to continue their life as they are. I mean, he was a millionaire, so they had good life. Or we throw you from the balcony and then it will be obvious that this wasn't a suicide, then everyone will ask why was he thrown, and then it will come out that you spied for the Israelis and your family will have to pay. So between these two evils, he chose the one that was rationally, he chose the one that was less bad.
And we'll never know the answer, I don't think.
Maybe one of these days, one of the persons who was in the bedroom, because they're still with us, one of them will come out. One Egyptian paper even gave their names, two men and a woman. And there was a series of similar accidents in London where Egyptians who were... could cause embarrassment to the government, fell down from the balconies. So they say it is more or less the same team each time. What do I know? I wasn't there in the bedroom.
But we're all interested. How did you come up with the idea for this book?
Well, it was, I mean, as I said, when I read the information that was available to Israel before the war, it was clear that we had this miraculous source. When you see the information, the pieces, the warnings, what he says, and you compare it to what happens, and we know what happened, and it is obvious that these men knew everything. And I also knew by then that his reports went as they were, in the original, directly to the prime minister, the defense minister, and the chief of staff. This is a very irregular source. So I'm interested in spying. So when you have such a spy, you want to write about him. So
right. Yeah. So it was a natural topic. And we talked a little bit about the value of human intelligence, but we have some questions from the audience, and it kind of changes the conversation a little bit. But here's one: how or what advice would you have for Donald Trump regarding the relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and regarding the use of spies in general? You can answer those in either order.
Well,
we all want to know. So.
Well, not all Americans are the same, not all Israelis are the same. Each of us is entitled to his own political views. Let me simply put it, my prime minister and myself, we don't share the same political views. So what can I tell Mr. Trump? I would tell him, look, Mr. Trump, do Israel a favor, pressure the Israelis to give up, to return the occupied territories, because if Israel doesn't do it, Israel in 10 years from now will be a binational state. It will not be a Jewish state anymore. And this will be the end of the Zionist dream. So please be a good Zionist and help us to preserve the dream. Whether he will do it or not, I don't know, maybe. With regard to intelligence, I'm afraid that the American intelligence system, the analytical component of the American intelligence system, especially the CIA, is going to face rough times. Because I read recently a book that will come out in a few months. I was asked to blurb the book by Mel Goodman, who was a senior analyst in the CIA. And he says something like, which I find it true, that intelligence analysts tend to be to vote for the Democrats, and the operation officers tend to vote for the Republicans. And I think that we're going to face a very difficult time for the Democratic analyst in the CIA, because unlike in many other countries in the world, in the United States there is a tradition that political pressures on the intelligence are allowed, are part of the game. and which is something that is unheard of in Israel. In Israel, even in, if Netanyahu thinks that, the Iranian deal is a bad deal, if the intelligence analysts believe it is or estimate it is a good deal, they will say it is a good deal and that's it. In the United States, we saw in Iraq before the war in Iraq that they can be influenced. So I'm afraid that there will be a very strong pressure on the CIA to produce estimates that will suit the political needs of the president. And this is very bad for intelligence.
Do you think in today's environment it would be the same, easier, or harder for someone like the angel to have the same kind of access to intelligence?
I really don't know. It is an excellent question, and I don't think that we have a good answer. But my guess is that anyone who serves close to the President of the United States knows a lot about American secrets, even more so in Russia, in a country like Russia. So if you have someone like Marwan, a close advisor of Putin, and you participate in the meetings of, I don't know what, it's not the Politburo anymore, but whatever is, or the NSC, or the NSC, you know almost everything. And again, I don't think that any technical means can get this type of information, inside information. And in this sense, the value of spies is still extremely important. Yes.
Very. Do you have any indication, Professor, of how well your book is being received in Egypt? Is it published there?
Well, we sold the rights for the Arabic language. It is not published yet, but Arab papers, especially in Egypt, published chapters of the book, etc. I read a little bit. I don't know. My Arabic is not good enough, so I had to use Google Translate, and the translation is not perfect, but you can understand what they say. And I think that it creates a debate among many in the Arab world, especially in Cairo, on whether or not the son-in-law of President Nasser was indeed a traitor, and what does it mean about, what does it tell us about us, the Egyptians, that we can produce such a traitor, et cetera, et cetera. But the details are not known yet.
Not known yet.
So I really don't know.
Yeah, well, it would be... Was he paid, Marwan?
Yes, Marwan was paid nicely. Part of his motivation was money. He wanted to gamble, you know, these kind of things. Altogether, he was paid about $1 million. He got two bonuses. One was $100,000 bonus for the warning of the Yom Kippur War. In my mind, $100,000 for this warning was a good price. The second is an even more interesting story, or almost interesting story, because he received $50,000 shortly before war started because he prevented a Libyan-Palestinian attempt to shoot down an El Al passenger plane over Rome airport in Fiumicino. And the Libyans wanted to take a revenge for the accidental shooting down of a Libyan passenger plane by Israeli aircraft over the Sinai. And Sadat, the Libyan leader, Gaddafi, came to Sadat and asked for his help. He needed Sadat's help because they wanted to use personal anti-aircraft missiles that only Egypt had at the time, SA-7s. So Sadat, who knew that the shooting down an Israeli passenger plane, a 747 in Rome, shortly before the war is not good in terms of achieving surprise, gave the job to Marwan to handle this whole project. Knowing that Marwan may go to the Italians and tell them about it, he probably told them, go tell the Italians. But Marwan didn't tell the Italians, of course. But the funny part of the story is that Marwan smuggled the missiles to Rome in a diplomatic bag, and he met the Palestinian terrorists who were supposed to take this action in a shoe store in Via Veneto. Very nice shoe store. Yes, very nice one.
Nice stores.
And they started talking, and Marwan told the terrorists, okay, I have the missiles in my car. Take them, put them in your car, and go away. So they told him, we don't have a car, which is really a problem. So they had to improvise. So they went to a next door rug store, and bought some rugs, and took the missiles, wrapped the missiles in the rugs, and carried them in the rugs in the Italian, in the Rome metro, to where they lived. And this way they organized a terrorist act, which could be the worst terrorist act so far, because the Israeli 747 carried something like 450 passengers.
Yes, big plane.
Big plane. And luckily for us, we knew about it ahead. Of course, he warned the Mossad that this is what's going to happen, and the Italian arrested them and prevented this terrorist act. And for this, he received another $50,000.
With which he could buy shoes on the Via Veneto.
Yes. This is more or less the price of the shoes, though. Believe me, they're very expensive.
You described that scene in the book, and I just think of these guys carrying missiles wrapped in rags in the subway
it's
in Rome.
Amazing.
It's a crazy story. What do you think is... from your personal perspective, knowing what you know, the prospect for peace in the Middle East?
Well, I think that we advanced quite a lot, because 20, 25 years ago, there was no agreement on what will be the terms of peace. Now we know more or less what there will be. There is a formula. Most Arab states, almost all Arab states, accept this formula. Many Muslim states accept this formula, and they say to, and there is a decision of the Arab League that we are ready to sign peace and normalize relations with Israel if Israel signs peace with the Palestinians on the basis of this formula, which calls for the evacuation of the West Bank, the returning of the West Bank to the Palestinians. In many respects, the decision now is Israeli, whether to meet these terms or not. So far, we did not. In part with American help, there was no American pressure. If you ask senior Israeli generals, what do they want? All they want is to get out of the West Bank. They can't do it because the political mood in Israel is against it. It is very difficult politically to do it. If we are pressured to do it, maybe we will. So the question, as usual, is in the hands of the United States, you know. And I think that as long as the United States won't do anything about it, we won't move.
It won't happen.
Yeah.
It won't happen. And going back to the angel... how is he viewed in Israel now? Is there a uniform perspective on him, or is he still viewed this way by intelligence and this way by Mossad?
I think that almost all the professional intelligence officers, they don't have any doubt that he spied for the Israelis, and it doesn't make any difference whether they belong to military intelligence or the Mossad. In fact, apart from the director of military intelligence who leaked his name, I don't know of any intelligence officer who really think that he was a double spy. It is different with regard to journalists, for example. Journalists like these stories, and the more complicated they are, the better it is. So they try still to convince the audience that maybe he was a double spy. And one of the known things about surprise attacks, is that they create lots of conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
We know that until today, many Americans believe that Roosevelt knew about Pearl Harbor and that it wasn't Al-Qaeda that did September 11, etc. And for the Israelis, also, the conspiracy theories exist with regard to the Yom Kippur War. So part of the conspiracy theory is that he was a double agent. But the problem with all the theories about double agent is one. If you deceive the Israelis, you have to show where the deception is. And until today, I don't see the deception.
Right.
I mean, the minute that he knew that the Egyptians are going to attack, he called the Israelis. So where's the deception? But if, you know, it's like a religion. If you believe in that he was a double agent.
You're always going to believe.
Nothing will change your mind.
He is a double agent. Mm-hmm. Are you working on a new book now?
I finished now a new book. It will come out in the spring about comparing cases of success and failure in preventing surprise attacks. And it compares the Russian experience in 1941, Barbarossa, the German attacks that surprised Stalin, and the way Stalin used intelligence in the Battle of Moscow, which was a very good way of using intelligence. It compares the first surprise in Korea, where the North Korean invaded South Korea, and then the Chinese intervention, and it compares the surprise of Yom Kippur with an Israeli success after the war started. And the sad conclusion that I come to is that the role of a single person is enormous in deciding the fate of history. And I said it's the sad conclusion because I'm not sure that we have today the leaders that are capable of leading us to a better future. And I think that in some countries we have or we might have leaders that will lead to very difficult situations.
So that we were talking before this program about the importance of who the leader is and the team of people directly around the leader, that they have immense power in terms of influencing decisions made and by doing so the path of history.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And we've seen it historically.
And it doesn't lead us to any optimist conclusions now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm afraid so.
We live in those kinds of times. As you think about Marwan, do you think he should be considered a hero?
For me, personally, he is a hero. Not because of the book, but I don't know what would have happened to me, what would have been my fate without him, because we lost so many soldiers in the war, fought in the war. He saved me, I don't know. He saved the lives of many Israelis. But if you treat hero as someone who, I mean, he was courageous. I mean, he was...
He's a risk taker, no doubt.
I mean, it's not even courage. But he's not the person that I would admire or anything like this. He wasn't a nice person,
right.
Mildly put.
Right. Yeah.
So he's not a hero, but I thank him. nevertheless.
Well, and the fact that he would just cold call the Israeli embassy in London, and from that the story continues, is quite miraculous. And is well told in this book, the angel that you've brought to us, and we thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
It's a very good read. Our thanks to Professor Uri Bar-Josef, professor at the University of Haifa, author of The Angel, The Egyptian Spy Who Saved Israel. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Janet Napolitano, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.